Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com. 2021 has gotten off to a hopeful start, in part because 2020 was such a drag and we're all anxious to move on. But there's plenty of drama left over from the past year, and while there are glimmers of hope in our collective prospects for some, others are continuing their fight to correct wrongs, address injustices and inequities, and to band together to make progress on as much of it as possible. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's colleague and co-host. Today we're going to take a look at two different views of this landscape, one that deals with the growing mountain of debt that has been acquired by thousands of students and many others who now need and deserve a new deal to help them get out of debt prison. And the other has to do with addressing the perception of constitutional violations of citizens' rights as being experienced in the COVID crisis. So we have two guests today who are on the front lines of these positions. One is Jason Wozniak of the Debt Collective, a national student debt movement organizing what they call debt strikes, calling for the abolition of student debts, and organizing around helping students to escape lifelong debt capture. And our other guest is a constitutional scholar, Professor Tim Canova, who believes that the government is stepping outside of its prescribed constitutional boundaries with demands for compliance with shutdown orders that have been impacting so much of our economy. Ellen will be talking with Tim Canova later in the program. But no matter what year it is in America, it's always a debt year. Ellen's landmark bestseller, Web of Debt, raised awareness for hundreds of thousands of Americans and others around the world who were suddenly awakened to the reality that our economic and monetary systems are built around debt, private debt mostly, namely owing money to participate in an economy driven by consumption, growth, and financialization. Virtually all of us are in a web of debt, and the monetary and financial system players intend to keep it that way. And clearly, this debt burden is not carried equally by all. The heaviest, most disabling debt is carried by those who, for whatever reasons, have the least ability to pay, and pay the most just to get by, which is a sizable percentage of our fellow citizens. Something has to give, and it would appear that some things are about to give way in the coming year. What can be done to address this onerous systemic burden of debt that plagues not only individuals but also our cities and states? We think public banks can make a big difference, but they're not panaceas and they're not charities. Clearly, the solutions for systemic debt are many and will not be easily resolved. But we first must prioritize providing some relief for those who are tragically suffering the inequities of debt-based capitalism. Now, let's talk with Ellen. So Ellen, it's a new year, but it's the same old story. Debt is running the show for the people all around the world. And now with the COVID crisis continuing, debts are mounting and people are stuck more than ever. What's the good news from your standpoint of what 2021 will look like?
That's a hard question. Well, I've written a lot about this before, and Michael Hodson has written about how debt is how we've basically been enslaved or entrapped, and that thousands of years ago, the lender was the government and the temple, and so they could just do a debt jubilee. Well, the problem is that today, as the Bank of England has acknowledged, our money is basically created by banks when they make loans, but they create the principal, they don't create the interest. So there's always more money owed back than was created in the original loan. Where are you going to get that extra money? Somebody has to go into debt. So you've just, it's really a Ponzi scheme, pyramid scheme. And eventually the debtors can't go any further into debt and the whole thing collapses. So we've seen that over and over. And 2008 was a classic example where the debts were basically housing debts. And now we've got COVID debts, or the fact that businesses have been shut down altogether. And there was a moratorium on rent that will be lifted shortly, apparently, unless Congress, I mean, you can't have a moratorium on rents forever because you're putting the burden on the landlords. But a lot of landlords are just people who moved and rented out their previous place, and they were counting on those rents to help pay the rent in the new place or something. You know, Michael Hudson argues we need a debt jubilee, but then the question is, how do you pull off a debt jubilee? Thousands of years ago, the king could just say, I forgive all the debts, and that's what he did do, and it worked fine. But you can't really do that now because the debts are privately owned. So we love the idea of public banks, of course. If the debts were all publicly owned, you could do that. And the Chinese do that. They own their banks, and they also pay for tuition. And, you know, they have many social benefits that we don't get. And that is, Michael Hudson has also argued that that's one reason we can't catch up with them, because our businesses are forced to pay the health care and the we have all these expenses that we personally, or that the businesses have to carry, that in China, the government does it. And where do they get the money? They are the issuer of their credit, of course, through their own state-owned banks, and they are able to issue the yuan themselves. So our government too could do that, but we don't want to go too far towards socialism, because what people are afraid of is the control mechanism that goes with socialism. Nobody really would mind, I don't think, having your basic expenses paid, you know, having education and healthcare, great, let's do it. But what everybody's worried about is that it'll all get manipulated by big businesses. So what routinely happens, and what we're seeing happening again, is that this debt bubble grows until it can't grow anymore, then it collapses. And the people who still have money go in and buy up all the properties, buy up the houses, as happened after 2008, and rent them back to the people that originally owned them. And in this case, we see the businesses getting bought up. The small local businesses are going out of business. So then the big businesses can come in and swoop up the market. So we've got that same syndrome going on, where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And unfortunately, no matter which party is in power, the rich always seem to call the shots. I mean, somehow they've got the big lobbyists and they manage to get their bills passed. Our answer is always public banking. We, the people, should own the banks. If we had a banking system like China does, not that we want to adopt their whole system, of course, but there are good things to be said. China's system was originally the American system, called the American system, where the government issues the money or the government issues the credit. The government can decide where the credit goes, et cetera.
You're absolutely right. The debt that's held by the big corporations and the banks is easily forgiven by the government that wants to keep these behemoths going, but nothing's done for the little folks. Our conversation coming up right now with Jason Wozniak of the Debt Collective builds on the themes that you talked about how private debt has taken over the lives of the citizens, and that our democracy is being undermined by this system, and that we have to come up with some new solutions. So thanks for that intro to this interesting conversation, Ellen. It's going to be an interesting year. So many things moving forward on the public banking front and on reconsidering what public policy should really be committed to. Ellen, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I'm pleased to be joined by Jason Wozniak, an organizer for the Pennsylvania Debt Collective, and also someone who works actively in the same category around the nation, to address the issue of the growing and really seemingly unredeemable issue of student debt and other debts. Jason, welcome to the program.
It's a real honor to be here. I appreciate it.
Well, tell us about what the debt collective is and how broad of a range of debt issues are you addressing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So long and the short of it, the debt collective has a rather long history insofar as it really started back during Occupy Wall Street. And the iteration then was known as strike debt. And so part of the initial impetus of the group was to really, as you mentioned earlier, to talk about not just student debt, but a variety of types of debt. Because as a lot of us know, and sometimes we use this phrase, that we live in a debt economy. That one way to maybe think of the neoliberal economy is to think of it as a debt economy. And that is to say that debt and to, you know, the other side of that, credit, is at the heart of this economy that we live under today. And then in a lot of ways impacts our lives in so many different directions. So since its initial start, the debt collective has been engaged in the struggle for debt abolition, but also to abolish other types of debt, like medical debt. And what we call household debt, so not consumer debt. And this is an important shift for us, that the debts that most Americans have to take on are debts that they take on because, you know, wages are stagnant and public services have been gutted over the last 40 plus years. And so these debts are debts that you need in order to allow your household to reproduce itself and to function. So whether that be taking on, you know, credit card debt to put gas in the car, or the bills that you have because of the doctor's visit and so on and so forth. These are the variety of different types of household debt that many Americans have to, you know, burden because we have an economy whereby wages have been stagnant and public services are very expensive, like education, like healthcare, so on and so forth. So we are full on with a student debt cancellation campaign that I'm sure we'll talk a little bit on. But we are also interested in other types of debt, including these credit card and medical. But I also want to say something, I think this is really relevant to the public banking, is that we have a deep interest in municipal debt. And, you know, for example, universities themselves are in debt. If you might call it the other type, the other side of the university debt crisis is the fact that universities themselves have major debts. Likewise, K-12 school districts, massively in debt, $400 billion. So these are all different types of debts that we want to address and that we can talk about, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, you begin, you provide a really a nice laying out the horizon of debt and how ubiquitous it is in the system of our monetary system and our economy. And I think we all recognize that this is a burden under which all of us, all of Americans, are cast. You guys have done a very creative step and really alleviated and eliminated debt for many people. Can you tell us a little bit about how you did that and whether or not that's a plan that you're planning to expand on going forward?
Yeah, so I think what you're referring to is a campaign early on, and this was again coming out of Wall Street during the strike debt days, of the Rolling Jubilee. So this was a campaign that admittedly I participated in very little and from an education standpoint, because I work a lot on political and public education. So the long and the short of it is that medical debts, when you can't pay your hospital bills, so on and so forth, they get sold into a market. And then what you have are these debt buyers who then you'll see they hound you forever. They'll go in and buy your debt for pennies on the dollar. And then they'll try and collect from you whatever they can, and they make a massive profit, right? So if I buy $1,000 worth of your debt for, let's say, $10, and then I get $500 out of you, then I've made massive profit, right? So on a large scale, this works. Well, it turns out that some of my comrades from the debt collective figured out that we could actually buy into that market if you organize yourself in a certain way. And so, long story short, there was a massive campaign to get into this, a lot of work that my comrades did. Bought into the market, did a fundraiser, raised millions of dollars, and actually was able to buy off the debt of many indebted folks to the tune of, I can't remember the exact amount, I think it was like $50 million. I would have to check. But instead of obviously collecting on those debts, what my friends did was put in a nicely packaged, either envelope or box, a letter to the person that owned, owed the debt, saying your debts have been bought off and forgiven. You owe no one anything, any else, so on and so forth. So that's just one way. Now, that won't work on a massive scale, right? Like this was more of a kind of an anarchist intervention, kind of an intervention just to really draw attention to a larger problem. Because we all know that we need Medicare for all, and we need the abolition of student debts, and student debts can't be abolished through independent fundraisers, right? We need federal intervention on that. So that was really just a way to draw attention to this bigger issue, but it is one of the ways in which we like to think of, like, you know, this is how you bring debtors together, because part of the issue is that debtors are so isolated. And most of us in debt suffer alone for a variety of reasons, whether that be feelings of guilt or shame or failure. And so what part of the, from the very beginning, the project has been to, like, show that alone we are very vulnerable, but together debtors have power. So how do we build that power? How do we bring debtors together? How do debtors come out of the closet to meet with one another to talk about what we can and can't do?
That's a really interesting variation of what we talk about, democratizing money, where we're getting money back into the control of money back into the hands of the people. Yeah. You're talking about democratizing debt.
Yeah. Well, I think this is really fascinating. One of the reasons why I think the public bank is such an interesting and important intervention, because to be totally honest, like, I'm not an economist. I study economy from, like, a critical theory perspective, but I'm not an economist. But I do think that one of the things that is so fascinating is that we have to rethink what democracy is or isn't in the debt economy. That in a lot of ways, we're governed by debt. And that's to say, on these large macro social way structures or social manners. So, like, if you look at just examples of Puerto Rico, you look at what happened to Greece, and then you look at what happens to, say, a school district like Philadelphia, whereby, or Chicago, where schools will get closed in order to pay creditors. That's not a democratic decision. You know, that's written into a contract where bond covenants state, and I know that specifically for Chicago during the Chicago closings, which impacted from, you know, principally POC and poor folks, that in the covenant, it says that the creditors have first dibs on available resources and that the schools have to work with what's left. Now, if we had a public bank, theoretically, and you would know more about this, you could negotiate that. Like, in times of crisis, well, we say, look, we're going to put money aside to make sure that our teachers, our students, so on and so forth are served. But in the way that things work now, undemocratic decisions happen so that creditors always get their cut. And I think really that what we really stress in the debt collective is that the debtor-creditor relation is a power relation, and it's asymmetrical insofar as the creditor normally has enormous power over the debtor,
yeah.
Which I think is something that the public bank really challenges.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned some really perfect examples of how upside down that makes our public policy making, because the commitments of a city budget that you illustrate in Chicago, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and other places, they have to pay those debts before they can actually implement the investments in public services and in public resources. They have to pay Wall Street first. So you're absolutely target spot on with that analysis. And what do we do about it? You know, I mean, this is the system that we're stuck in. And there's also a sense of almost like an ethical responsibility to pay debt. How do you deal with the people who say, look, you're going to forgive debts for people who took them on? Shouldn't they be accountable for them?
Okay, so that's beautiful. And because I was going to say, the other interest of mine that's really fascinating is the ethics of debt, and how there's a lot to say about this, right? But, just to go backwards a little bit, the word debt in German, Schuld, means guilt and shame. For hundreds of years, thousands of years, debt has been something that's been used as a means to make other people feel guilt and failure. It's kind of born, it's part of our country's DNA, and there's a lot of interesting books in, like, the field of American studies about this. So part of what we try to do is to delegitimize the ethics of domination. That's a term by a Argentine philosopher, Enrique Dussel. And one of the things that Dussel says is that there's ethics of domination that reinscribe and reproduce these asymmetrical power relationships. And so it's through this ethical framework that says, if you owe a debt by any means, you have to like give your blood, sweat, and tears to pay it off. Mm-hmm. That's a way to create a power and power relation and maintain that relation. And so one of the things that we work on, and we do this through, like we have what we call Jubilee schools, which are 3 to 4 week training sessions. And one of the main focuses of the Jubilee schools is to say that debt that you have been forced to take on is not your fault. And you should not feel shame about having had to go into debt to put, you know, food in the mouths of your children, to get an education, to care for your elders, so on and so forth. That is not your fault. The ethical condemnation should be on the people that set up a system that has placed individuals and to a larger extent cities and so on and so forth in the situation whereby they are now forced to live their lives according to the debts that they owe. And so really there's an important, I think, and this comes into like public education, like how do we flip that script, that narrative around the ethics of debt to say like, we're not at fault for having gone into debt when we're just trying to survive and get by.
But certainly when you take on a debt to buy an education or to or for any object, you do make a commitment, say, look, I want to borrow your money and I promise you I'll pay you back.
Right.
That is an ethical stance and a responsible stance. At what point in that transactional relationship do things go wrong? Do you think that the system should be is suspect?
Sure. And I think this is where we get into really interesting conversations about what we can call ideal and non-ideal philosophy. So with ideal philosophy, we would have this conception of like under all circumstances, you have to pay the debt because you signed a contract and you made a promise. But when we do non-ideal philosophy, what we try and do is take into consideration context. And so an example would be, you know, predatory loans an example would be a payday loan. Now, I would argue that under a certain ideal philosophy framework, you would say, well, the person that took out the payday loan has to pay that loan because they signed a piece of paper and a contract, so on and so forth. But I could make a good argument saying that, yeah, but when someone is under the situation whereby they have to take out a loan because of a certain social context, because of a long history of oppression, so on and so forth, then in actuality, I can make an ethical argument that they should not pay back that lender. Now, in the case of education, where we're talking about student debts, what we need to realize is the history of where the student debt problem comes from. You know, we need to remember that at a point in our country's history, higher education was for the most part free, and or you could work a part-time job and pay off your tuition. Now, that changes drastically in the 1970s and 80s and onward, whereby as soon as we see a massive push in social movements to have more inclusion in universities, there's a tax revolt led by Ronald Reagan and other people. And, you know, you see this in what's called the Trilateral Commission. They actually say there's too much democracy. There's too much uprisings happening on campuses across the country. How do we keep that down? Well, one of the ways you keep that down is you jack tuition, you cut funding on the state and federal level for higher ed, and then you force people into a debt relationship. And, you know, education today is unattainable for the majority of people in this country without going into debt. And so I would argue that this is one of the reasons, too, why we're not asking for debt forgiveness, because no one did anything wrong. We're asking for debt abolition, which is to say, again, that we're challenging this ethical framework around the notion of a contract and so on and so forth.
So abolition and forgiveness are different. You're making a distinction between the two.
Yeah.
Would you speak a little bit more about how they're different?
Sure. Just in the sense of, and this is kind of a rhetorical play, right? In the sense, and that has ethical implications. So to the degree in which, you know, to ask for forgiveness is to imply that we did something wrong and that we want to be forgiven for it. But as I said earlier, no student debtor that had to take on debt to get an education has done anything wrong in through our perspective. And so rather than ask forgiveness, make the stronger claim and say, no, this should be abolished because it should have never existed in the first place, especially in the richest country in the world. Especially if you look into what like some of the MMT folks like Stephanie Kelton and other people say, you know, we could absorb that student debt and it would be like 0.05% onto the federal debt. Their studies say it wouldn't do anything to inflation. So why should we have to beg for quote unquote forgiveness? Let's abolish it. Mm-hmm. Get rid of it.
So the idea of a debt jubilee, our friend and colleague, Dr. Michael Hudson, talks about the jubilee going back thousands of years to Sumer, where a new administration, as it were, or a new kingship or leadership would come in and forgive the debts to the kingdom for the sake of, and most of them were agricultural, for the sake of keeping the system going, for being able to keep people in the game. What I hear you describing is much more a systemic, an attack or an approach to systemic reformation that eliminates the tyranny and the mechanics of the tyranny of debt, which clearly we're all stuck with.
Right. That's a beautiful formulation. That the way you laid that out is very nice and very eloquent. And you know, Hudson's work is fantastic in this regard. And you're right. You know, like we've one of the original founders of Strike Debt was David Graeber, rest in power, who recently passed.
There you go.
You know, David obviously wrote the book that 5,000 years, so on and so forth. And this also comes up in his work, this notion of jubilee throughout time in order to maintain the system. Yeah. And to a degree, I mean, this is an interesting discussion, right? And this, and here, like, depending on how far you go to the left, there's a lot to be said about this. But one could argue that, and many people are making this argument, that student debt abolition is actually really good for the capitalist economy. You know, he puts more money in people's pockets, so on and so forth. Okay, fine. Admittedly, a lot of us in Strike Debt and or the debt collective have more of a socialist tinge, whereby like this is the way for us, and this argument's been made by other people. By attacking debt, you do get to a certain degree at the heart of, you know, 21st century financial capital. What would it mean, as you mentioned earlier on in the program, like to really start to expand this analysis and movement action beyond student debt to like housing debt to medical debt, so on and so forth. Well, then you start to get into some really interesting struggles with capital and some major forces, as you know.
You're given that the financial markets thrive on mortgage-backed securities and on this whole financial play, the tricks of moving capital between people at expense, continuing to extract and suck out from our society and our commonwealth, the resources that we need to proceed. You know, you're really talking about fundamental systemic change here. And I suppose we're at a point in the evolution of our democratic economy our economy is that if we don't make it more democratic, we will clearly realize what we're on the road, far down the road realizing, which is a neo-feudalist kind of dependency.
Yeah.
We have, you've mentioned the categories of student debt, of food, of medical debt. So how would it be, how would you propose, or what are some of the things on your agenda for to-do list? Mm-hmm. How we get past this?
Yeah, this is the great question, right? Like what is to be done? And as you were speaking just now, there's a title of a book by the Italian philosopher Maurizio Lazzarato called Governing by Debt. And, you know, even the word economy, if you go back to the root oikonomia, means like the governance of the household, right? And so really, we need to think through this lens of political economy and how it governs our lives, how it governs our societies, and how debt plays a role in then governing what we do or don't do as individuals and as a collective group, right, as a society. So the question about what we do about this, I mean, this is why I'm so interested in some of the work that you all are doing with the public bank, because I think the public bank is one of the ways that we get to reimagine the ways in which we prioritize public goods, the ways in which we think about democracy, the ways in which money is at our use, not being extracted, as you said. I think that's a great term that we need to use more often when we talk about debt, that these are extractions of public goods into the hands of private interests. So, you know, accumulation by dispossession, as like David Harvey might say. So I do think that the public bank is one step in the direction of like making our money more democratic, to use maybe some of your wording. I also think that one of the things that we're simultaneously struggling for is, you know, we could eliminate student debt, let's say, but if we don't have a free, robust funding formula for higher education, we're going to reproduce this problem, you know, 10, 20 years down the road. And so side by side with the fight for student debt abolition is the fight for what we call a reparative public higher education system. And by that, the reparative word here is really important, because in our nation's history, you know, universities have not always been accessible and or just to a variety of marginalized groups. And so we ask the question, to what degree can universities be a reparative institution that addresses some of our nation's wrongs, that addresses some of the ways in which universities have been complicit in, you know, for example, slave trade, slave financing, so on and so forth, and make it a space whereby it's not just a free public good, it's a free public good that plays this reparative role in addressing some of the nation's wrongs and legacies, right? And so I think, you know, just to give two examples, that the public bank would be one step towards is dealing with this larger systemic problem, as would a federally funded public reparative university.
Something that you used the word household, and that's something, the household debt, it's a metaphor that Stephanie Kelton uses in describing how the modern monetary notion theory, MMT, deals with the distinction between our notion of household debt and who is the household, the nation. When you look at the nation as the household, and you see that you're not constrained by a typical purse-based household debt, I'm only limited to this much money, but instead your household says, look, everybody here needs to have an education. We need to have healthy people, and we can't have people living on the street, and everybody should have a right to have some food at least. So these fundamental household responsibilities and aspects are creeping into, in a variety of different ways, the creation of public policy. So your discussion about debt is really, I think, I love the breadth with which you're approaching this, because it includes the elements of things like banking, but also a fundamental addressing of who we are as a society, a society with ethics and moral commitments. It's a very interesting and very important kind of a discussion, and we really appreciate the work that you're doing, Jason, to address it, bring it to the table, and to maybe hopefully in this coming decade get a whole new fix on how we can address and incorporate a new vision of commonwealth of how we're going to make it together.
Yeah, and I just want to give a shout out to all the work that you all have been doing here. You know, I'm in Philadelphia as well, and you know, with Stan, and then I always miss Neighborhood Networks. There's a network, Neighborhood, I always forget, but
Neighborhood Networks. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the work that the Neighborhood Networks is doing around this issue of public banking is so important, and I just want to really say that we admire all the work that you all have done. How you all have opened up new horizons of thinking about what money's for and who gets to control it, and therefore democracy and ethical questions. Just a ton of respect for all the work that you have put into this.
Thanks, Jason. Thank you very much. It's actually an exciting time to be here, and to my generation, which got its feet into street activity back in the 70s and 60s. Yeah. You know, are now seeing the culmination of the commitments that we've made to each other, winding up really on the verge of maybe having some public policy prospects with the changes and so forth. So,
that's beautiful. Do you mind if I just say really quick about you saying about the commitments that we have to each other? This is something we talk about, like, who do we really owe what? Like, you know, our commitment should be to each other. And like our responsibilities to each other. And so what you just said there is really important. Thank you.
duly noted. And thank you very much for being on the program. I know we'll be talking and connecting on this going forward.
All right. Thanks a lot, Walt.
Take care. I've been speaking with Jason Wozniak, a national activist and organizer with The Debt Collective, which you can reach at debtcollective.org.
I'm pleased to be talking with Tim Canova, professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University in Florida, and a recent addition to the Public Banking Institute Advisory Board. We're delighted to have you. Tim has taught at a number of universities, served as legislative assistant to the late Senator Paul Tsongas, and served on an advisory committee put together by Bernie Sanders several years ago on reforming the Fed. He also ran for Florida representative to the U.S. House of Representatives, challenging Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So, Tim, it's great to be talking to you again.
Thank you, Alan.
So, I know you're you've written some great stuff on public banks, but I know that's not your focus right now, so I won't probe you there. I know you're focused now on more on constitutional issues, which I guess you teach. Is that correct?
Yes.
Constitutional law, yeah.
First Amendment law, in fact.
So we have a lot of those things going on right now. And one thing I thought I would ask you about, you know, the World Economic Forum in January is meeting on the Great Reset, which traditionally resets mean like financial resets, like when the world went off the gold standard and we had the Bretton Woods agreement where, first of all, it was a gold-backed dollar, and then Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, so then it was just the dollar, and then it was basically an oil-backed dollar, etc. But resets usually mean finances, but it appears from, I mean, they're very vague about it, even on the World Economic Forum website, which covers everything. They're not just talking about money, they're talking about everything in our lives, and it's all going to be technocratically controlled. And it looks like the currency will be central bank digital currencies. 80% of countries are expected to have central bank digital currencies in the next couple of years. And the International Monetary Fund is talking about this great reset. And I'm guessing they expect to be issuing the reserve currency, something on the order of SDRs, the special drawing rights that they issue now. But the whole thing is so controlled. I mean, it's not democratic. It's a top-down, you know, so that's quite frightening. And then we have all the First Amendment issues right now about, of course, vaccines. We have election issues. We try to be middle of the road on this show, so we can't talk too much about politics. So you've been researching First Amendment rights, and particularly things like rights over sovereignty over our own bodies. So what do you think? Will there be lawsuits? There's also the issue of censorship of things that are private. So maybe they have the right to censor their own things, Twitter and Google and YouTube and so forth. But they are preventing free speech. That if the major media don't talk about these things and the private media don't talk about them, I mean, it's no longer democracy if you don't have freedom of speech and freedom of the press.
There's so many First Amendment issues and constitutional issues, it's hard to know where to start. You know, the subject of mandatory vaccinations, I'm sure, will be coming up. Some states are probably going to want to mandate vaccinations and restrict religious exemptions. Those who claim that governments have a right to forcibly vaccinate people or to imprison or fine them if they refuse are generally relying on a Supreme Court decision that's over 100 years old, Jacobson versus the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And they really are misreading the case, I believe. The case was much more narrow than what they're assuming. It leaves open the possibility that even under the framework of Jacobson of striking down mandatory vaccinations. But it comes from an era when the court also upheld forced sterilizations, where individuals perhaps did not have the kind of rights that the present Supreme Court, I believe, would be trying to protect. I think that there is a majority on this court now that is more likely to intervene against state mandates. You also mentioned the social media censorship, which is emerging very quickly as a constitutional issue. As it is now, these social media giants, they have what's known as a Section 230 exemption. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act shields them from liability for defamation lawsuits. In return, they're supposed to be neutral platforms. They're not publishers. They're not editors of content, with the one exception of what's known as the Good Samaritan exception, where they're supposed to be able to restrict content that is obscene, harassment, or otherwise offensive. But then beyond that, I think that there is going to be, and already is, some desire on the Supreme Court to apply the First Amendment to these giant social media companies. And there is precedent in the past. So I think that this is, these are some of the First Amendment issues that will be coming up. You mentioned the Great Reset and the World Economic Forum. What's fascinating about it is all these global institutions, the World Economic Forum, the International Monetary Fund, and World Bank, they've decided that the Great Reset is here, that this is what we all have to do. It's a wonderful opportunity. That is, the COVID virus, the pandemic, is a wonderful opportunity to reset our economies. Notice it's not been done in any kind of a democratic way. There's been no discussion of legislative bodies anywhere around the world about whether to even embark on this brave new world. So it's the idea that we are going to have a zero emission economy because of the threat of climate change. What does it look like to have a zero emission economy?
Plus, you know, if airlines don't let you fly, if employers don't let you work, if stores don't let you shop,
yes,
where do you get your food? And then there's this argument that you're a danger to the public, you know, if you're not vaccinated or whatever. So
I do think there's going to be a ton of lawsuits challenging this. And my guess is they will go up to the Supreme Court. The United States might be culturally and institutionally less inclined to join that Great Reset than some other countries that don't have a stronger Bill of Rights and a stronger tradition to protect individual liberties. But I don't think it's something that we can take for granted here either.
So if it were challenged, there are grounds for challenging it, even though it's a private airline or?
Well, yes, they're open to public accommodations. You know, so the civil rights statutes apply. To what degree they would apply in this instance, I'm not sure. One would hope, of course, that the Congress of the United States would have something to say and not just sit on the sidelines. But it's all too apparent that so many of our institutions, including the legislative branch, have been influenced and perhaps corrupted by some of these large corporate interests that are behind the Great Reset, which include big Wall Street financial institutions, big pharma, big technology companies. So I'm not quite sure if putting our trust in these representatives will get us very far.
What about the possibility of, can you sue like Amazon for antitrust? Or, I mean, here they've destroyed all the small businesses. This was a government mandate. It's not, you can't say the virus destroyed them. It was the government, state governments that have shut down these businesses. And then they've let the large businesses stand. Is that a constitutional issue?
Well, there are antitrust concerns, I think, that the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission should have been pursuing for many years, not just against Amazon, but against Facebook and Twitter and Google for monopolizing industries. And if they felt the laws were not keeping up with technology, they should have been seeking to amend the laws so that they would have better interpretations of antitrust prosecutions in the courts. However, I do think that there's also plenty of room for private lawsuits to push back. For instance, when a governor puts out one of these executive orders that close down small businesses and allow superstores to stay open, one could argue that that is a taking of private property without just compensation, a violation of the Fifth Amendment applicable to the states through the 14th Amendment. So right there, that's a pretty good grounds for challenging these edicts as an improper taking of private property. And, you know, the recent Supreme Court decision, again, in I think it was the Catholic Archdiocese of Brooklyn against Andrew Cuomo, both Gorsuch and Alito's written opinions were very encouraging. The idea that even in emergencies, you don't the Constitution is not suspended. If you're suspending the Constitution every time an executive declares an emergency, then we don't really have rights. We have just permissions. That you could have executives putting big parts of the economy out of business, destroying families, destroying family-owned businesses, and no repercussions whatsoever. Another legal recourse, which I think we see happening in Colorado, where the governor's executive orders have put hundreds of small businesses out of business, are 1983 claims. Section 1983, 42 U.S.C. 1983, is a federal statute that allows for private plaintiffs to sue for damages for deprivation of their civil rights and constitutional rights under color of law. And that's exactly what we see has happened all over the country. I hope that there are a lot of 1983 claims. I hope there are a lot of Fifth Amendment claims for unlawful, unconstitutional takings without just compensation. I think that these governors should be liable and the state governments should be liable. This should never happen again. There should really be investigations of this whole narrative, and we should be doing the investigations. You know, quite often, you know, we want criminal investigations. I don't have much faith that the Justice Department or the FBI is capable of doing much of anything. There should be legislative investigations. Congressional committees should be holding public hearings on all of these issues. But whenever they've held any hearings during this COVID, they have Dr. Anthony Fauci, and that's about it. They don't have dissenting scientists. So the problem is we've got one kind of science. It's the official established science, like an official established church. And the CDC is the high priest of it. Political scientists have just forgotten all about captured agencies, all about the idea that our regulatory agencies could be captured and are regularly captured by the industries they're charged with regulating. Bernie Sanders used to talk about this all the time during his campaigns, how the FDA has been taken over by Big Pharma, and the greatest threat to our health is that Big Pharma will what? Charge us 10 times what they should or what other country, other people around the world pay for their drugs, that we don't get generic drugs. If only that was the extent of the capture, that we're paying extra for drugs. There's a real possibility that the capture has reached a point where they're able to declare pandemics that are not real pandemics.
Yeah, which means shutting down your business, which means removing your livelihood, which is an unconstitutional taking of property without due process.
Well, you know, I'm not practicing law now, but I am working with others who are. I teach instead of practice, but I've been consulting with a number of people bringing lawsuits. And again, I do think the takings type of a lawsuit is a perfect one that hasn't happened yet, as far as I know, but it should. And the Section 1983 claims, I think, are just beginning to rev up.
Oh, that's great. So how do you define due process? Like, what should they have done in the case of lockdowns?
Well, for the takings argument, it's the Fifth Amendment prohibits a taking of private property for a public purpose without just compensation. So it's not even really making a due process argument as much as everyone deserves just compensation for their businesses being wiped out. One could argue about due process as well. The 14th Amendment due process clause was used in many important cases. Early in the 1900s, it struck down economic legislation, such as health and safety regulations, as violating what was known as substantive due process. And it gave the substantive due process doctrine a black eye. I'm not sure how a due process argument would pan out. There's a good separation of powers argument as well. that governors should not be declaring emergencies. Legislative branches should be involved in that. Now, if it's a real emergency and a legislative branch can't meet, maybe there's an argument that a governor can take some immediate action. But these emergencies have been going on for months while legislative branches have been largely silent.
Other countries are looking to us. Like you say, they don't have strong Bill of Rights like we do. And so it has to be fought out here, it seems to me.
It seems that way to me, too. I think the United States is at a real important crossroads right now. And should we go down the wrong pathway next year in 2021, it's going to look real bad for the rest of the world. I do think the rest of the world is looking to the United States for leadership here. And while a lot of the governments around the world might be opposed to the Trump administration's approach on this, the peoples around the world are much different than the governments. We see mass protests in many countries, Germany, France now. People are standing up. In some countries, the people don't even have the freedom to stand up and protest. And it's really quite shocking when you see countries that come from that Anglo-American type of a tradition, like Australia, where the people seem to be perpetually locked down inside their homes.
And in Australia, I think they don't have a Bill of Rights. I saw that somewhere.
That's right.
Yeah. So, and if we don't have sovereignty over our own bodies, what do we have? I mean, that's really the one piece of property that you'd think we could claim would be our own bodies.
And I do think it's conditioning everyone for what could happen next with the idea that we should all be taking vaccinations for the greater good as well. Even though it's really almost unheard of that there's any kind of mandatory vaccinations for adults. When you think about the kind of market we're talking about for big pharma, 7.7 billion people globally, a vaccination that I'm sure is not going to be a one-time vaccine. It'll be a precedent to have multiple vaccines for every human being on planet Earth. So this is a trillion-dollar agenda, multi-trillion dollars. And the possible adverse health effects would be multiplied exponentially if their plan is to have mandatory vaccinations for every person on planet Earth.
I saw that they were advertising for a computer program that would detect anyone talking about adverse reactions. And this was supposed to be because there would be so many adverse reactions that they couldn't do it manually. But you could just imagine that the whole point of that program is to delete all those things so that other people don't hear about them. I mean, if we aren't able to communicate with other people through the mass media, we're in the dark, you know, we are back into the dark ages.
Truly, you know, the First Amendment is first for a reason, because the idea that freedom of speech and freedom of the press is absolutely fundamental to having a political system based on democracy, deliberation, discussion, debate, and the rule of law requires free speech. It requires a free, vigilant press, a media. Mm-hmm. And instead, look where we are at this point. We've got five huge corporate conglomerates that control 90% of the TV, radio, cable, broadcast, and print media. And
all of which are in the Council on Foreign Relations. I just an article about that on Zero Hedge.
So, exactly.
Like, I know people who say, well, government's just not that organized. They couldn't get together and all plan to do this, but they do get together. The Council on Foreign Relations gets together. The World Economic Forum gets together. Those are like 3,000 people that show up that are all the heads of the biggest companies, and along with politicians and bureaucrats, technocrats. Yeah.
Right. Yep.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's great to have your insights, and it's great to have you on our advisory board.
Well, it's wonderful to be on the advisory board for the Public Banking Institute. I've been, you know, cheering it on for so long and been part of it at various conferences and initiatives. It does seem to be a moment where public banking has been rising in visibility, and more people are turning to it, not just now, but I think over the last few years, thanks to your efforts. And it does seem to be the way to go, both at the state level and to make our own central bank more accountable Of course, we've spoken about that before, how at the federal level, what would public banking look like? It would look like a Federal Reserve that's not owned and captured by private banks. It would also look like it did during the 1940s when there was a Reconstruction Finance Corporation, basically a public infrastructure bank. So all of that is badly needed. And you and I have spoken about this before. I know you've written in favor of universal basic income, and I've spoken up for it as well. I've always been more partial to a federal jobs guarantee than just a uniform basic income. But now the discussions of a UBI take on a more sinister tone, I think, because it's the idea that UBI will be digitalized. And that will give some central authorities the ability to cut off your income flow if you're not obeying whatever their edicts are, whether it's social distancing or it's vaccinating oneself and one's children and one's family.
Or even just the social credit score that they have in China. I mean, we already know that there is a major precedent for this that's quite alarming. So that is one more legal issue. Can we prevent that? Can we demand that the universal basic income not have strings attached, just like Social Security? You know, you get it no matter what kind of traffic violations you've done or whatever, you still get your Social Security.
It's going to depend on a lot of lawyers willing to bring lawsuits and plaintiffs willing to fund a lot of those lawsuits. So I do think that there's a good opportunity to push back on these kinds of edicts. UBI is by its very nature state action. It's money coming from the federal government or state governments perhaps, and therefore putting strings attached that violate individual autonomy and individual rights, I think would be very problematic, I would hope. You know, it's like when we're having this conversation, we're talking about, we're looking at it through a lens of what this country was like for many decades. A country that had a constitution and a Bill of Rights. And now one wonders to what degree many of those rights have already been sacrificed or will be sacrificed on the altar of safety and perceived safety or promised safety and security. And, you know, it reminds me of, I think, what Ben Franklin once said about those who sacrifice freedom for security will end up with neither and deserve neither.
Yeah, it's also biblical. I think I have a friend who keeps quoting passages, and one of them is, you know, when they are seeking peace and security, that's the end times, which is where we are.
Well, it does seem that way sometimes. It really does.
Well, thank you so much for your insights. Great talking to you.
Well, thank you for having me on, Ellen. I appreciate it.
Ellen has been speaking with Tim Canova, Professor of Law and Public Finance at Nova Southeast University. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.